Quest for Quality is an educational production of iPro. Opinions expressed reflect the views of the speaker only and not those of any company or agency. This podcast is intended for private, non-commercial use only. Please visit qi.ipro.org to read our full disclaimer and terms and conditions.
Welcome to the Quest for Quality, the podcast for the iPro Quality Innovation Network Quality Improvement Organization, or QIN-QIO. I am Tosin David, a pharmacist working with the iPro QIN-QIO, and I'll be your host. In 2017, the White House declared the opioid crisis a public health emergency. Since then, given the considerable harms of opioids, various programs and initiatives have sought to reduce unnecessary or inappropriate prescribing of opioids throughout the United States. In late 2022, the Centers of Disease Control and Prevention updated the 2016 Clinical Practice Guideline for prescribing opioids for pain management. The new guideline continues to encourage limiting the use of opioids in favor of as effective, less harmful, non-drug, and non-opioid treatment options. The guidelines also focus on the proper use of opioids to manage pain. Many clinicians are familiar with the use of buprenorphine for opioid use disorders, but most are not aware or rarely prescribe buprenorphine for pain management. Today, we will take a deeper look at buprenorphine as an agent to support pain management, particularly when other opioids have failed chronically treated patients, but also as an initial option when initiating an opioid is being considered. For today's conversation, it is a pleasure to have Dr. Daniel Berlin on the podcast. Dr. Berlin is a clinical associate professor in the Department of Medicine and Anesthesiology and is board certified in internal medicine and addiction medicine. He practices and teaches in both departments, concentrating mainly on the management of complex chronic pain patients who have been treated with polypharmacy controlled medication regimens that put those individuals at high risk for medication toxicity and poor quality of life. He has developed numerous inpatient and ambulatory pain management protocols and order sets. He has co-authored various publications, including the University of Michigan Chronic Pain Management Guideline, and regularly speaks at local, state, and national meetings on comprehensive pain assessment and controlled medication management. Dr. Berlin, welcome, and thank you for joining us today.
Well, thank you, and glad to see you and hear you from the University of Michigan.
So, Dr. Berlin, the approach to pain management tends to be controversial. In your experience, what are the key elements of pain management?
Well, the key element not to do is to say the patient has pain and prescribe opioids. So chronic pain is a different illness from acute pain that is not is often related to tissue damage of some sort and would be expected to resolve with healing. Chronic pain becomes an entirely different animal and becomes an illness less of the somatosensory areas of the brain and over time more of the emotional areas of the brain and actually then turns into suffering. And what people need to recognize before they start prescribing is there a pain generator that should be looked for, assessed, and treated locally versus a systemic disease causing more widespread pain that can be treated systemically? Think things such as lupus, or is it a centralized pain that has become a phenomenon of the central nervous system and requires specific treatments directed at it, sometimes neuropathic type pain medicines, but mostly centrally acting agents. Most of the time, this would be a contraindication to opioids. So think diseases like fibromyalgia, irritable bowel, chronic nonspecific back pain. And so the assessment has to include a look for possible local pain generators to treat, but also coexisting psychological problems that could now become a more consistent indicator of pain catastrophizing and reasons not to give people dangerous medications.
Yeah, I agree. Finding the root source is important. So, and based on your opinion, where do opioids fit into pain management, and then specifically buprenorphine?
So opioids certainly can have a role in an acute pain syndrome if somebody's in an accident or is in post-op, and for some reason NSAIDs are not adequate treatment, then opioids are certainly relevant. But in the long run, for people treated for more than just even a few days, people develop rapid tolerance to opioids. And if that turns into escalating doses, that can actually cause increased pain. So buprenorphine is another opioid, which means it should have a fairly limited role, but there are some very significant specific advantages of buprenorphine over other full agonist opioids. And thus probably finally may explain why the VA has finally gotten on board with their recently published guideline saying that if people are going to use opioids, that buprenorphine should probably be the first line opioid.
Yes, and you alluded to this, but could you provide more detail on how and why buprenorphine works differently as a partial mu opioid receptor agonist?
First of all, the first misconception about buprenorphine is that it's not an analgesic, when in fact it is, and it could be as much as 30 times as potent as morphine or hydrocodone. As a partial agonist, it has a ceiling effect for some of its toxicities, particularly respiratory suppression. And so suddenly it becomes a much safer opioid. There are many other advantages. We don't seem to see tolerance develop with buprenorphine, so it's not a dead-end drug like other opioids. Further, it's not a downer the way most full agonists are, and a patient's mood and energy is better with the lower side effect profile, and it actually kind of works like an antidepressant in some patients. And so there are all sorts of advantages, not to mention much less abuse potential because of its slow onset of activity. And of course, the way it's marketed in films and patches and buccal films, then again, it's a much safer product.
Yes, definitely. But some clinicians are concerned about a ceiling effect. Could you explain that and explain how it could potentially even be a positive thing when it comes to buprenorphine?
So as I said before, the ceiling effect applies to respiratory depression. But there is no real ceiling effect for analgesia. So some of the preparations that we can prescribe, we would say, have a limited benefit up to certain morphine equivalents. But that's because of the nature of the way they're permitted by the FDA, not so much a problem with the drug.
Thank you. So yes, buprenorphine has a lot of positive benefits, but every medication has some side effects. What side effects or monitoring parameters would you want to let our audience know about today when it comes to buprenorphine?
Well, as an opioid, you're obliged to monitor patients to make sure they're using the medication properly. So when people are taking it, you would obviously have to, especially in some states where it's state law, follow the PDMP, the prescription registry. And we encourage urine drug testing in patients who overlap between pain and opioid use disorder, knowing that most chronic pain patients are not just pure pain. They especially if treated with opioids, they start down the spectrum toward drug dependency and or even frank opioid use disorder. So you would be monitoring that for proper use of medication and safety. In the most extreme cases, I've been known to do pill or film counts on patients, but certainly with the topical forms of it, that's really unnecessary.
Thank you. You alluded to a lot of the various formulations of buprenorphine. When it comes to chronic pain, there are two formulations, a buccal film and a transdermal patch with FDA indication. Many clinicians are familiar with buprenorphine sublingual formulations used in opioid use disorder. Could you further explain the formulations that are used for opioid use disorder and how they can be used off-label to assist with pain management?
So, yeah, the traditional sublingual films are generic tablets of buprenorphine naloxone, the combination product. Obviously, they've been around since the early 2000s. And we've been using them in pain management in our pain clinic for probably at least 15 years now. When prescribed off-label for pain, what we find is that the doses are far lower than the typical doses that people have been taught regarding treating opiate use disorder with sublingual buprenorphine. So it's very useful, but it's different. People don't want to overdose their, relatively overdose, that is, knowing they can't do too much harm, overdose their pain patients. We find that pain doses of sublingual buprenorphine are in the range of 1 to 8 milligrams, as opposed to OUD patients who often require 8 to 16 or sometimes even higher doses initially to suppress opioid craving and obtaining illicit drugs. That answer your question?
Yes, yes. For any of the listeners here today, we created the guide for clinicians that review the different formulations of buprenorphine as a resource. So feel free to check that in our resource library. So for patients that are on chronic buprenorphine for chronic pain management, how would you approach acute pain in those patients?
So it's been tradition, again, since people started seeing patients treated either for OUD or pain with sublingual buprenorphine, it's been tradition if somebody's going to have a major pain-producing procedure or is involved in an accident and it's felt that either IV or oral NSAID isn't adequate for analgesia and that opioids are needed, it's been tradition to stop buprenorphine because of its so-called blocking effect. Well, buprenorphine isn't really an opioid blocker. It has higher affinity than other opioids at the mu-1 receptor, sort of the way Narcan does. And so it wouldn't allow weak opioids to get to those receptors to provide additional analgesia. Well, it turns out that because it clears off the receptors after 5 or 6 hours after each dose, that receptor availability is present enough that you can just dose people with full agonist opiates right on top of buprenorphine. In fact, outcome studies have showed much better pain relief, more consistent relief, and much less risk for relapse to opiate use disorder that's illicit in those patients who had that issue, and that's why they were on sublingual buprenorphine. So we recommend, instead of giving people just once daily dosing if they're being treated for OUD, of splitting the dose into 3 or 4 doses, and then you can give hydromorphone, morphine, oxycodone, or hydrocodone intermittently, and people do just fine with that.
Yes, definitely an art with managing acute pain with patients that already have chronic pain management. So for patients with any type of chronic opioid, regardless, do you recommend naloxone for those patients?
So these days, you could argue everybody should be carrying naloxone around in their pockets.
I agree.
For pure patients, pure pain patients without a significant component of OUD, you could argue naloxone is excessive, but again, if we're all supposed to carry it around, certainly for anybody who may misuse their opioid, whether it's buprenorphine or intermittently getting into something they shouldn't be getting into, those patients may run out of opioids and then at that point put themselves at risk for obtaining illicit or prescribed medications from others. And at that point become at risk for overdose, and so certainly they should have naloxone. We haven't really talked about the topical forms much of buprenorphine. So I'd like to say a few words about that, if that's okay.
Please, please.
So you asked at the beginning about buccal and transdermal, and this is where the big gap is in prescribing by most practitioners. So for patients who are either opioid naive or have been on low doses of opioids chronically and now say they're not doing well, either because of tolerance or because they want more, or they're sort of intermittently okay and then spending most of the day when they're not taking their BID hydrocodone, they're feeling bad most of the day, these are perfect candidates for a switch to transdermal buprenorphine. So with the topical forms, transdermal or buccal, you basically just start them. So with transdermal, you slap on a patch that's good for a week and just stop the other medication. They can continue their Tylenol or NSAID or whatever else they're taking. But there's no fancy induction protocol or provoked withdrawal that people have heard about from sublingual buprenorphine. With buccal, it's the same thing. Generally, it's given 2 to 3 times a day. But again, very low abuse potential. And you just start the medication and stop whatever else they were on. It's simple. Whereas with sublingual, people need an opioid-free interval to let their receptors clear off so that when the buprenorphine comes along, they're not thrown off and put into acute withdrawal. For the vast majority of patients on sublingual, though, even that protocol is quite simple because they just stop whatever they've been taking for 12 hours and then go ahead and start their first sublingual doses of buprenorphine. The exception would be methadone and fentanyl. That they hang around forever, and those people can be at risk for provoked withdrawal. And so we recommend getting help from someone experienced if people haven't done it before with the sublingual route. With buccal and transdermal, it's really not a problem.
Thank you. And to our viewers, we also work with Dr. Berlin to create a initiation guide to help you different clinicians figure out ways and different best practices on utilizing buprenorphine. So Dr. Berlin, thank you so much for providing such a wealth of information regarding the use of buprenorphine for chronic pain management. To close our conversation today, are there any other key points that you would like our audience to hear?
Well, the most key point would be that people should become familiar immediately with using buccal or transdermal buprenorphine because most of your patients who are chronically treated with opioids are not doing well, and moving them to what's essentially a low-risk, longer-acting, sustained medication, they are going to thank you for it. The problem, of course, with them, those two, is that they're expensive and sometimes insurance won't pay. And that's an enormous barrier we still have to get through. But with changing guidelines and people understanding that maybe instead of starting people on oxycodone, they would start them on transdermal or buccal buprenorphine as a first-line agent, as suggested by the VA, people would find that this is a much better way to treat people who are not adequately treated by physical therapy, NSAIDs, psychotherapy, and sometimes non-opioid adjuvant drugs like gabapentin or pregabalin. So that would be my message, is get familiar with these drugs and even consider using them as first-line agents.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. Berlin. Your expertise is much appreciated. And I would like to thank the listeners for tuning in today. If you would like more information on our different pain management resources or even more information about the iProClin QIO, please look at qio.ipro.org. Thank you so much for tuning in today.
Okay.